Thank you for joining us for another podcast from the Commonwealth Club of California.
Now, it is my pleasure, so please join me in giving a very warm welcome to Sheryl Sandberg, Adam Grant, and Julie Lithcott-Hames.
Thank you, Marissa. Hello, everybody, and welcome to tonight's program with Marissa's In Forum at the Commonwealth Club. We are here in the Castro in San Francisco, California. We're on the radio, so I want the folks at home to kind of know what it feels like. We're not only in the Castro, we are at the Castro Theater, and the energy in this room is electric. It is sold out. There are 1,400 people here. The line for the women's room is probably still very long. But we shall.
I always enjoy a line for the women's room.
I know, right?
It's always good.
I think the tech execs in this always community could pick that, right? I'm Julie Lithcott-Hames. I'm the former dean of freshmen at Stanford, and I'm the author of How to Raise an Adult. And it is my incredible
Woo!
Pleasure.
Thank you.
It is my pleasure, my honor, to be in conversation tonight with these two. Sheryl Sandberg, COO of Facebook, and Adam Grant, Professor of Management and Psychology at Wharton. Both are best-selling authors in their own right. Both are co-authors of the incredible new book, Option B, and a little birdie just told me Option B spent the first week of its life as the number one book on Amazon. We are here because 2 years ago, this past Monday, Dave Goldberg died. We are here because 156 days later, his beloved wife, Sheryl Sandberg, decided to try to live again. We are here because Sheryl, with the help of Adam, decided she needed to tell this story. And we are here because we need to hear it, because we want to hear it, because as humans, we hunger to know how we're supposed to survive the events hardly any of us can manage to even talk about. I mean, here you are, 1,400 of you, gathered in a majestic theater to hear us talk about grief, loss, death, trauma. I mean, what is it with you people? And here's what it is with you people. You're people. We are all humans. We've got a gooey inside. And this book, I think, at its most basic, is about acknowledging that. No matter who we are, how magnificent, we cry, we weep, we suffer, and we figure out how to go on. So that's what we're here to talk about tonight. Let's get started. Sheryl, let's begin with a very happy story. Tell us how you met Dave.
It was 1996. Some of you are old enough to remember when that was. I appreciate those of you. I had just finished business school. I had just gotten divorced. I was quite young to do that. I moved to LA. I didn't know a lot of people. And a few months later, I was dating someone. He was out of town. I had not much to do on a Saturday night. And a friend of mine invited me to dinner and a movie with his friend. That friend was Dave. We went to the movie. I fell asleep on his shoulder. As he told the story later, he thought I was really into him. Until he got to know me and realized I would sleep on anyone's shoulder in any movie. In fact, I lived in the Castro for many years. I slept on a lot of shoulders in this same room we're in. Some of them I knew. Sometimes it didn't work out that way. And Dave became my friend. In L.A., when I was living there, didn't feel like home until I met him. And I think having just been divorced, I wasn't ready to find the right person. So I dated a bunch of the wrong people. And I remember breaking up with one of them. I said to my mom, I said, why are you breaking up? I said, I don't feel lucky. I want to feel lucky to be with the person I'm with. And she said, what do you mean? I said, well, whoever marries Dave Goldberg will be the luckiest woman in the world. And she said, you're supposed to be smart.
Oh, oh my gosh.
And so Dave and I started dating and got married, had two children. Dave was, there's a bunch of women here, amazing women right in the front row who used to work at SurveyMonkey with Dave. Yeah. For you guys. Dave was brilliant. He had his own ideas and own way of looking at the world, but he also was open to anyone else's. Dave was funny. He played an awful lot of April Fool's jokes. Not always on April Fool's, almost always on me. I miss those jokes. Yeah. Dave was a great husband, a great father, a great CEO. And Dave was a rock. I'm kind of more up and down. Dave was... And Dave was always the one who told me it would be okay. Always.
And then Dave was gone.
Yeah.
Tell us what happened. Tell us what changed 2 years ago.
It was Monday of this week, this year, 2 years ago. We were at our friend Phil's 50th birthday party in Mexico, and I woke up on what I thought was a normal day. Felt like a normal day. We went hiking, we had breakfast, and then it wasn't. He went to the gym, he didn't come back, his brother and I found him. And then I flew home to tell my children. It is the unimaginable. And I sit here knowing that I'm not the only person in this room who's faced the unimaginable. There are so many people here who have those moments in your life where everything changes and you just can't even believe you're living through it. And for me, the grief, it just felt like a void closing in on me. Yeah. My brother-in-law, Rob, Dave's only sibling, talked about it as a boot on his chest. Yeah. And my biggest fear, and you're the child expert, your book is the only assigned reading I've ever given all my friends and family. Everyone, read this. But seriously, I care so much about how to raise my kids. And before this, I was worried about all the things you write about in your book. And all of a sudden, I was worried that their happiness would just be gone. In that instant, we lost Dave, and that's when I turned to my friend Adam to say, what do I do?
Yeah.
How do I get my children and myself through this?
Yeah.
And that's the...
Before we turn to Adam, Cheryl just shared something. I know Adam's like, okay. Well, but here's... I want to try to practice what this book asks us to be. Sheryl Sandberg just said, you know, this terrible thing happened. It was the unimaginable. I lost my partner, my beloved. I had to go home and face my kids. And I could feel the energy in this audience leaping out toward her. Those of you who've had these experiences, I could feel you leaping out to say, yeah, me too. So I want us to just burst into a bit of applause right now for the fact that humans go through this. And Cheryl just shared what she's been through. And that takes guts. And we need to feel seen and to know we matter when that happens. Even 2 years later. Even 2 years later. Absolutely. Adam.
Hi, Julie.
You come into the picture at some point. You guys are friends somehow. So tell us about that. I don't mean somehow, like, how could you be friends with her?
I didn't take it that way until you said that. I mean, I didn't even think of that.
It was the look on his face, like, okay, what are you getting at, Julie? We'd love to know who you are in Cheryl's life, how you know one another. And then I know from the book that you gave her some pretty important advice. So tell us about that as well.
So it was about 4 years ago. I ran into Dave at a conference. And he had read my first book, which was on generosity. And it was just so clear from the questions that he asked me that he lived everything that I was trying to study. And he proceeded to give me one of the greatest gifts that I've ever received, which is he introduced me to Cheryl. And I remember him saying, you know, you should come over for dinner. We'd love to chat with you. I'm like, no. I don't want to go to anyone's house for dinner. I don't want to impose. I'm sure you have enough going on in your life. And he said, no, we'd really love to have you. And I felt like I couldn't say no, so I said yes. And I remember showing up at dinner, and their 5-year-old daughter asked me how my day was.
Whoa.
5 years old. Like, mm-hmm. My 8-year-old still doesn't do that.
I can't promise you actually listen to the answer, but well, try.
And then their seven-year-old son started quoting from my book.
Ooh. Welcome to Silicon Valley, Adam.
I want to be clear. He didn't read the book.
I didn't know that.
Dad had prepped him.
Okay. I did not know that at the time, and I was pretty stunned.
Who are these children?
But, you know, in retrospect, it was such a clear reflection of who Dave was and who Cheryl is, just always focusing on other people. And after dinner, Cheryl started grilling me about gender differences in my data.
I always feel like grilling is not a fair verb.
It probably is, I'm guessing.
Grilling was a soft
description. I felt like it was a nice series of
It was a full-on interrogation.
Your children already know everything about him.
I felt like you were a prosecuting attorney, and I couldn't defend my case. But I had a long flight back east, and so I reanalyzed a decade of my own data. I was horrified by what I found about how men and women were treated differently for the same acts of helping and speaking up, and sent the data to Cheryl, and she said we should write about this. And so we started writing together, and it's hard to write with someone without becoming friends. And that was, I guess, how the friendship began.
That's so beautifully put. All right, so the two of you are friends, and then the unimaginable happens. Tell us what happened next. How did you step up as a friend in a circumstance when, frankly, many friends don't know what to do or what to say?
I didn't know what to do either. I came out for the funeral, and afterward, Cheryl had some family and friends stay, and she asked me, what can I do to get my children through it? And, you know, all I could think was to say, I know what's going to help you in this situation. I'm going to give you mountains of data. But actually, that was, as a psychologist, that was all I could think because, yeah. You know, for me, data are just lots of other people's experiences at once. And so I just started talking to her a little bit about what we know about how to raise resilient kids. And that began, I guess that began the conversation that ultimately turned into this book.
So what do we know about how to raise resilient kids?
Well, we're going to ask the book
you.
On it.
No. We're going to ask you to. There's no one better equipped. Julie kindly joined the advisory board of optionb.org because you are the expert on how to raise resilient kids. We wrote a chapter. You wrote a book.
I feel as if this pause is expecting me to sort of fill
Correct.
It with some thoughts here. Nothing in my notes tells me what to say, so I'm going to try to remember, you know, my own book. You know, it's... I'm just acknowledging that I'm on the stage with these two amazing people, and okay, I'm going to try to put my hat on and, like, you know, be the other me. We need to show our kids that struggle happens in life. There's a chapter in my book called Normalized Struggle. We in communities like this one, San Francisco, Greater Bay Area, your community in Pennsylvania, and plenty of other places, we tend to try to perfect our children's childhood and make it lovely and easy and filled with sunlight. And when we overdo that, we can end up really underpreparing them for the blows that life will throw their way. And so normalizing struggle, as Brené Brown would say, acknowledging the vulnerability, not pretending it doesn't exist, but sitting with them, talking it through, being good role models, letting them know when bad things happened to us and how it felt and how we coped and how we moved on. We are our kids' greatest role models in probably every single way. And building resilience, coping with adversity is one of the most important things I think we can teach kids.
And Julie, that's one of the first things we started talking about is the importance of knowing that it's okay to ask for help. I want to give Cheryl a chance to talk about that, but there are two really amazing men in this room mm-hmm. who are in the book, Danny and Steven, both of whom had been to prison and went to Berkeley afterward and discovered that there wasn't a lot of support there for people who are affected by incarceration, and they started the Underground Scholars Initiative. And one of the most powerful things that we've taken away from them is that, as Danny puts it, asking for help is not a sign of weakness, it's a sign of strength.
Beautiful. Beautiful. Absolutely. But to this point of parents and children, to this tragedy of the loss of a spouse and a parent, sometimes I think we are inclined to go to, I'm worried about my children. You know, one step removed from the self are your precious children, and they are obviously your first concern. Sometimes, though, it can be hard to claim one's own right to be suffering and grieving. I remember when I lost my father when I was 27, so many of my friends could ask me, how was my mom? But they couldn't ask me how I was. And since they couldn't ask me, whenever I had a thought about how I was doing or wasn't doing, I felt selfish. I don't have the right to feel this way. Of course my mother is grieving more than I am. She just lost her spouse. You know, and yet I was desperate also to be seen in that. So here you are, devoted mother to these two. When did you decide you had the right and the obligation for your own wellness to look at your own grief in the mirror, to tell it to yourself, and then, of course, to start to begin so bravely to share it with the world?
Well, it really was Adam who looked at me and said, if you do not let yourself recover, they can't.
Okay.
They cannot. And what happened, and it's to your point of no one talking, is that it wasn't just the grief and the fog and the boot on my chest. What happened after Dave died was real isolation.
Yeah.
Before Dave died, you know, I drop my kids off. They go to public school in Menlo Park. Everyone's, hi.
Right.
Go to work. Everyone chit-chats. Facebook, a really friendly place. Not so much. Mm-hmm. I think people were so afraid to say the wrong thing, they often said nothing at all. And I saw myself in this.
Yeah.
Before I lost Dave, if someone was going through something hard, maybe I'd say something the first time, but then I didn't want to remind them.
Yeah. Guess
what? You can't remind me I lost Dave to this day.
Mm-mm.
You can't remind someone they have cancer,
right,
that their mother just went to prison, that they just lost their job. It's not possible. So when we don't acknowledge, we're really leaving people alone.
Yep.
And what I learned was that acknowledgement, the elephant in the room, all of these hardships bring this huge elephant into every room. You want to completely silence a room? Yeah. Say you have cancer.
Yeah.
You want to completely silence a room, lose your husband, lose a child. And we leave people alone when we need them the most. And what I learned was the power of someone saying to me, we are going to get through this. And that's where the name of the book comes from.
Yeah.
I was talking to my friend Phil. It was his birthday party we were at when Dave died. A few weeks later, there was a father-son activity my son was signed up for. We came up with options for someone to fill in. We were able to give my son choices. He chose his uncle. But I looked at Phil and said, I want Dave.
Yeah.
Dave's supposed to go to this with our son. And he said, well, option A is not available. Let's kick the shit out of option B. We are going to do it. Not you are going to get through this.
Yeah.
But always we.
Beautiful.
And the other thing I really learned, and this was something I also really got wrong before, was rather than offer to do anything, the power of just doing something.
Right.
I used to say this all the time. Is there anything I can do?
Exactly.
And I meant it.
And it puts the onus, though, on the person who's suffering.
That's right. I meant it, but it does. It shifts the burden to that person. And when I was on the other side of that question, you know, the thoughts that would come to mind, well, can you make Father's Day go away? Because I still have to live through it, right? I mean,
right.
There's nothing to, it's too hard to ask. My dear friends who live here too, Dan and Esther Levy, they tragically lost a child. They were in the hospital for many months. And one of his friends texted and said, I'm in the lobby of the hospital for a hug if you come down or not for the next hour.
Mm.
And my sister's friend heard this story.
Mm-hmm.
She read the book. And she had a friend, not a close friend, but a friend, who was in the hospital with a child. And she said before she read option B, she would have done nothing because she's not the person's best friend.
Right.
She read the book.
Yeah.
So she went and she bought a toy. And she went to the lobby of the hospital last week. And she said, I'm in the lobby with this toy for your child. If you have a few minutes, otherwise I'll leave it down here for you.
Yeah.
The mother texted. She went upstairs, gave the four-year-old the child. She said the mother was standing behind the child weeping. Thank you for being here.
Yeah.
You don't have to be someone's best friend from the first grade to show up.
Right.
You're not imposing.
Right.
If you offer, I'm here if you need me. It is we if you need me. You may or may not want to talk right now, but if you want to, I'm here and I feel this with you.
Write this down. Write this down. Make note of it. Remember it. The next time it happens to somebody in your life, whatever the it is, see if you can be that person who leans in instead of pulls back and backs away and leaves that person lonely. You know, I had some neighbors and friends who lost a child to suicide a couple years ago, and I didn't know them super well. You know, carpool, pick up, drop off, but we'd not had dinner together. You know, we'd not confided in one another. I don't think we'd had a glass of wine together. And I got the news that terrible morning, and my instinct was to drive to their house. And I thought, you know, surely there are people that they're closer to than me. I know that. But I'm just going to go and knock on the door and read the vibe. And I will, if they let me in, I will stay there until someone who knows them better shows up. And I stayed for hours because I think too many of us don't know how to show up. And the only reason I know how to show up, and I'm not trying to brag, I lost my brother at 26 and I lost my father at 27 and experienced the loneliness of the community pulling back. I mean, that's the one good that came of it, is I feel now I can speak the language of loss and grief and show up and ask somebody like you, how are you doing today? And be able to handle whatever you say. And you might say, I don't want to get out of bed. I'm not sure I can go on. And we all need people who can say, yeah, I bet. Right. I see you. I get it. You know, let's figure out how today's going to go. Right?
Yeah. No, that's exactly it. And I do think we can do so much more of that for each other.
So we've talked about kids and we've talked about friends, but let's talk about the workplace. Because I think the most unkind place to be when you've suffered a tragedy, unless you're really lucky and you're at a special place with people who get it, is the workplace. Because you're given a day or two of bereavement. You know, you're given a week or two to kind of get the fog out of your head and kind of get back to it. When our loss can take over us for decades. So here you are, COO of Facebook. We're giggling backstage because there's all this promo of Twitter, and we got the Facebook COO here, right? So here you are at Facebook, right? You have the capacity to influence the work-life experience of however many employees y'all have. How has this experience changed you as the uber manager of that place?
It's changed me a lot. On a policy level, I've thought so much about what people face. And you're right. Most people get either no bereavement leave or 3 days.
Yeah.
3 days.
Right.
Someone wrote that who lost a child, you know, I got months when my child was born, and that person's lucky.
Right.
Not everyone gets that. And 3 days when that child died.
Right.
And so Facebook, we had really generous policies before, but we doubled them. We give 20 days of bereavement leave for immediate family and 10 for extended family.
That's beautiful.
A lot of family leave and you know, no unlimited sick leave, et cetera. We need better policies. Our companies don't have the right policies. And our public policy, we're not in a good place. We're one of the only countries in the world without paid family and medical leave.
Right.
There's something else I learned, which is how important rebuilding people was. And this took me by surprise. I'd read about grief. I hadn't experienced it like this. So when the anger came,
yeah,
at least I'd heard of that, even though a lot more of it came than I was prepared for.
Yeah.
When the sadness came, that wasn't a shock, even though, again, it was much worse than I could have expected.
Yeah.
But what I didn't expect is it really trashed my self-confidence in all other areas of my life. And I wrote a whole book on self-confidence.
Yeah, you did.
I ran around the country and the world telling other women to lean in. We have 33,000 lean in circles. And giving those other women advice on their confidence, you say something long enough, you start taking the advice yourself.
Yeah.
So I was feeling in a better place than I'd ever. I was pretty open and lean in about the times I struggled with self-confidence. But when this happened, I was in the best place I'd at least ever been. Mm. And then it just felt like my confidence was flattened like a house in a minute. I'd never thought about it before. But, you know, I went back to work. I could barely get through a meeting without crying.
Yeah.
Couldn't not think about Dave and what I was going through. Had trouble focusing. At home, I was parenting with a partner, and now I had to parent two grieving children. I had no experience in this. And what I used to say to people when they would come back and they were facing hardship was, do you want time off? But if they chose to be there, I thought my job was to take the pressure off them. You don't have to do that project, or don't worry, of course you can't concentrate with all you're going through. Well, a lot of people said that to me, just like I'd said that to others.
Mm-hmm.
When you think you can't do your job, someone's saying, of course you can't focus.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of convinces you
right.
can't do your job.
Right.
And what Mark did, and I honestly have no idea how he knew how to do this. He's 15 years younger than I am. He said, you can take all the time off you want. But then he said, when I fell asleep in a meeting, everyone sleeps in meetings. No one sleeps in meetings.
Oh, millennials.
No one sleeps in meetings. Or if I made a mistake, you would have made that mistake before. But what he really did was he said, you made a great point in that meeting. Or he would, you know, be there, I wanted to wait till you could be here because I want your opinion.
Yeah.
I can't believe anyone wanted my opinion. And now when people come back to work, I give them all the time off they want. But if they choose to be there, I now know the power of saying to them, do you want to do that project? I still believe in you. No pressure. But we want your opinion on this. Or great job today doing something that they might not have needed a compliment for before.
So you're helping bring them back. Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. You're helping that, you're helping restore that human, or not restore, but rebuild. You're helping that human become that next more healthy, more resilient version of themselves. It's beautiful. Adam, let's go back to you and your data. Right? You're,
I love Adam's
sort of,
data.
Right? The data. You've written all these books about humans. You know, you're a psychology prof at Wharton. You know, so your contribution to the book. Tell us, for those who haven't yet had a chance to read the book, and now's a great opportunity to say it is on sale here after the event, and you can also get it online, of course. Adam, what, you know, give us the nutshell, distill down the research that led to your co-authoring this book, Option B, Facing Adversity, Building Resilience, and Finding Joy. What does that actually look like?
Well, the first, you know, after Cheryl sort of got the message, she can be a little slow sometimes, but eventually she got the message. If, you know, if she didn't get through this, then her kids were going to struggle more. And, you know, then she started asking, well, how much resilience do I have? It's like, that's the wrong question. It's not a fixed trait. It's a lifelong project. And let's talk about how you build resilience. So we started talking about these traps that a lot of people fall into. You know that song, Everything is Awesome? Okay, maybe some people know the song. For those who don't, Cheryl was kind of living like the opposite, which is everything is awful. and they can be broken down into these three P's. So there's personalization, pervasiveness, and permanence.
Okay.
Personalization, something goes wrong and we're like, oh my gosh, this is all my fault, right? Like, it's not her, it's definitely me.
Yeah.
We've all been through that. For Cheryl, personalization was blaming herself for Dave dying and then apologizing constantly for it. I would get phone calls on a pretty regular basis that would not even start with hello or this is Cheryl, but I'm so sorry to bother you.
Yeah.
And, you know, eventually I was just like, look, you didn't interrupt, you know, other people's lives. Tragedy did. And it's not a burden to let the people who care about you help you, but you got to stop saying you're sorry. And I just banned sorry. No more sorries. So the next day she comes back and she says, I apologize. That's not okay either. But we talked a lot about how to overcome personalization and not say sorry, not say this is my fault.
Yeah.
And then the other two P's are, you know, pervasiveness is about saying this is going to ruin every part of my life.
Yeah.
And permanence is saying I'm going to feel this way forever. And I just kept saying, look, that's not true. Cheryl, I remember hating that line in your Facebook post 30 days after Dave died, which, you know, which said, I will never feel pure joy again. I'm like, ah, permanence police. You can't say never. Like, you don't know how you're going to feel in 6 months or a year. And every time you say never, you need to replace it with, right now it feels like I will not feel pure joy again.
And it was interesting when I wrote this post 30 days
after. Let's talk about that post.
Yeah, the isolation.
Well, you know.
No, the grief, yeah.
Well, it came on 30 days, or after 30 days for a reason. Tell people the period of
mourning.
It's
called Shloshim. Right. It's the Jewish period of mourning. It's 30 days after burial. And it was just like worse and worse and worse, the grief and the isolation and no one talking. And I just felt so bad. And I had been journaling a ton. And so a few days before I wrote this post, which is like, this is what I would say if I could speak. And I went to bed the night before thinking, there's zero chance I'm writing it. It's your description. It was the gooey inside, and it was raw and very personal and filled with grief, filled with sentences which were like, I will never feel pure joy again. And the next morning I woke up, and it was so bad. I felt so, it was the hard to get out of bed days, of which I had a lot, but this was like a particularly bad one.
Yeah.
And I thought to myself, well, it's not going to make it worse, and it might make it better. Got to do something.
Okay.
And so I hit post, and it really helped. It did not bring Dave back, and it did not take away the grief. But a friend of mine from work had been driving by my house, she told me, almost every day.
Stalker alert.
No, and she's a great friend. She came in, and she told me, I've been driving by your house 5 times a week.
Yeah.
But I was afraid to come in and bother you, and she started coming in. And strangers, a woman from the NICU posted that she was in the NICU having lost one of 2 twins, and she wanted to give that surviving baby a good life. Mm. And someone else who had lost a twin posted to her and said, here I am.
Yeah.
And I I still had the grief, but I felt less alone.
Yes.
And it was really the path that led to this book and then to the Option B community we launched to try to give each other a place to connect and a way to think about this and talk about it.
You are listening to the Commonwealth Club of California. Listen to thousands of our podcasts on iTunes or Google Play. And when you're in the Bay Area, please join us live for one of our 450 programs each year. You can find us online at commonwealthclub.org. And now, back to our program.
So when most of us hit post, we get like 17, 30, 100, you know, I mean, like, pick your number, but it ain't your number, right? So Sheryl Sandberg hits a post, you know, post a post, and it went, like, enormously viral, right? So in an instant, you had, I don't know the numbers, you know the numbers.
Well, this was the most shared or, like, thing I'd ever done, and I was kind of shocked. I thought at the time I posted, and I realized I work at Facebook, so, like, I get that I posted publicly, I really do. But I was talking to my friends and the people around me and the people at school, the people I interacted with, but it tapped into something,
And
it tapped into what happens when we are brutally honest about what's going on in our lives, and that things are hard and we need each other. We build resilience. What I learned working with Adam on this book and with you and our amazing advisory board launching the community, it's what you wrote in your book. We build resilience in ourselves and in each other. We build it in our children. We build it in our communities.
Yep.
We build it into our friendships by being there and by sharing what's really going on.
You know what we all have in common in this enormous, gorgeous theater, and everyone listening on the live stream and on the podcast and on the radio, what we all have in common as humans is that we're desperate to know that we matter. Mm-hmm. You know, we all need to know we matter, not to everybody, you know, but to someone. And when we are experiencing these terrible, terrible losses, you know, that's when we need most to know, you know, yeah, you matter to me. I see you. I see what you're going through. I'm there for you. So that post was for you, and yet it turned out to be this incredible catharsis that helped you, so many, so many others, that, as you've said, led to this amazing book, led to the Option B organization, right? I mean, it's just become this gift to the world. As you began to emerge slowly, you know, into the self you will become, you know, you began helping others. I mean, Facebook is amazing, Sheryl Sandberg. Lean In is amazing. But Option B, to see us in the core of our humanity like this and to serve all of us in this way, and Adam Grant, thank you. This is a tremendous service to our community.
Yeah. You know, my favorite, there are so many amazing stories of people who have faced all forms of hardship in the book, and one of my favorite is from Joe Casper. Mm. He's a doctor, so he dealt with other people's life and death regularly, but then his son died. And he went back to get a master's in psychology where he met Adam. And he said that now he's a doctor, but in his spare time, he counsels bereaved parents. Yeah. And he says in the book that he thinks it's his co-destiny with his deceased son, Ryan, that he's extending his son's life by doing good in his name. And for me, when people ask why do this? Dave, and there are so many people here in our hometown that knew him. Dave was incredible at the funeral. Maybe this is done all the time. I've never seen it done before. Our friend Xander asked all the people, raise your hand if Dave Goldberg changed your life. To this, a sea of hands went up. To this day, I meet people I've never heard of who don't say I knew your husband. They say he changed my life because he was so generous. And so if this book and the community and the great work that people are doing, sharing, does any good, it honors his life. It is the extension of Dave Goldberg's legacy. And for me, that has all the meaning in the world.
It does, and it is. Absolutely. I want to shift to this next phase and stage that you're in. You are emerging through your grief, through your loss, toward what is next. The book's, you know, subtitle contemplates that a human can find joy, you know, after tragedy, after loss. And so let's talk about rediscovering joy, Adam. How do we do that?
I don't know. I just study this stuff, right?
What do the data show, Adam, about joy?
No, look, I think, you know, one of the things that's so salient to me is I realize there's some people in this audience that have never set foot in a bookstore or don't realize that there's still such a thing as bookstores. But if you go into a bookstore, you will notice that there's a big self-help section. Mm. And what we want to know is, where's the help others section? Mm. Because
we want our book put in that section.
Ideally.
Yeah, absolutely.
Unclear whether the self-help books are helpful or not. But I think that one of the things I learned from watching Cheryl is that we really become resilient for other people, and we often find joy for other people. Mm. It was really her wanting to help her kids experience joy that led her to say, okay, if I find joy, then, you know, that will have an effect on my children.
Yeah.
And one of the things we talked about was, so that Facebook post did say, I will never feel pure joy again, but it yeah. also said, I am going to try to find joy and meaning. And I was like, aha, here's an opening. And so if you want to try to find joy, let's talk about noticing it.
Yeah.
So many people think that joy is about really intense positive experiences, like, you know, getting a big promotion or, you know, winning a major competition or
getting
married.
Getting kids into college, to your book.
Yeah, I mean, those big moments.
Let that be a measure of joy, right?
I know, but that's what people think.
No, I know.
That's the point.
Yes.
It's supposed to be those intense celebrations, but it's not the intensity of those moments that matters. It's the frequency.
Yeah.
And it's how much joy you find on those forgettable Wednesdays, as our friend Tim Urban calls them. And so, you know, the conversation with Cheryl was very much, okay, so why don't you just try to identify three moments of joy every day? And so she started making a list, and what came back was not inspiring in the least. It was like I drank less coffee today. Woo!
It's a big accomplishment for me. I drink a lot of coffee.
But there is really compelling evidence that when people just write down three moments of joy every day, their happiness goes up. And what happens is it changes their attention. We are so wired to pay attention to the negatives in our life, right? Like, in our prehistoric times, like, if you didn't notice the negative, you'd be like, oh, I see something orange with black stripes moving in the jungle.
You're dead.
I wonder if that's a tiger. You're dead,
yes,
right?
Yes.
What you're supposed to do is, like, tiger, run! And then you get to survive. And because of that, right, we are predisposed to focus on things that are going to go wrong because that's survival relevant, and we don't pay enough attention to joy. And I think Cheryl really experienced how much it matters to notice those moments.
This three moments of joy, if we can give one gift to everyone here, write down three moments of joy at the end of the day. I didn't realize before this, I went to bed every night worried about what I did wrong, what I was going to do wrong the next day, what I was going to mess up, what was going to fall down. But because I'm going to write down three moments of joy, it's not just that it helps that moment at the end of the day. I notice them. That's going to make the notebook, you know?
Yep.
What you said about this is part of being human.
Yeah.
That was a moment of joy for me. And I noticed it. I thought that right then when you said it, that makes the notebook. And so it extends those. And one of the things I learned working on this book with Adam is joy is a discipline. We have to work at it, particularly after tragedy, but even in general. And everyone, no matter what you have been through, whether you've lost a husband or a child or you are staring at illness in the face or you've, you know, done something you regret, self-compassion, joy, every single person deserves that. And we have to play that role of giving it to each other, but also, to your point, giving ourselves permission to feel it.
Yeah. You know, a lot of us, I think, speak the language of gratitude. You know, gratitude practice, it's important to have a gratitude practice. I'm wondering what the relationship is, Professor, between gratitude and joy. Are we really talking about quite similar things? Because I know a lot of people here probably are paying attention to what they're grateful for, maybe even acknowledging it. Or are they different things? Is one a deeper expression of the thing than the other?
Yeah, so they do turn out to be really different. So gratitude contributes to joy, right? People who feel more gratitude, who feel it more often, they live more joyful lives. And it's one of the most consistent drivers of happiness. That being said, it's different in the sense that gratitude is all about relationships. It's about appreciating what other people have done for you and, you know, the things that are available for you, the benefits you've received. Joy can occur outside of relationships, right? Like we all laugh watching movies and TV shows sitting alone. that doesn't require an interaction with another human. Gratitude usually does. Okay. And I think one of the more surprising things that we talked about was, I remember, Cheryl, about 2.5 weeks after Dave passed away, we were sitting with your mom on your floor, and I said, I think you should imagine how this could be worse.
And I looked at him like, you're this unbelievably brilliant person, but you've just lost it.
Yeah.
Because
Dave died
2 weeks ago. Worse?
Right.
What are you talking about?
And the only thing I can think of was that Dave died of a cardiac arrhythmia, and that could have happened when he was driving in the car with your children.
And you say that, and all of a sudden, I literally sat up on the floor. I'm like, I'm good. My kids are alive. That happens. That happens to people. You can lose everyone at once, and it never occurred to me. But the second it did, I thought, oh, my God, my kids are alive. I'm okay.
Yeah.
And it's so counterintuitive.
Yeah.
I would have thought, I'm looking for positive psychology. I got to find happy thoughts. But actually gratitude.
Yeah.
And it wasn't just gratitude that they were alive. It was gratitude for my own life.
Yes.
It never occurred to me that Dave would not turn 50.
Yeah.
Or 48. Mm-hmm. It never occurred to me that I wouldn't grow old, that he wouldn't. And I used to make jokes about growing old. All right, be honest, everyone. Raise your hand if you've made a joke about not wanting to grow old. Okay, I know more of you have done that. Let's take an honest moment. Raise your hand if you've made it. Yeah. We all do that. My cousin Laura turned 50 on Valentine's Day, and I called her and I said, I'm calling to say happy birthday. But I'm also calling because in case you woke up this morning with that, oh my God, I'm 50 thing, this is the year Dave doesn't turn 50.
Yeah.
And there are two paths. We grow old or we don't. And so every single year is a gift. And I will never make another joke about growing old again because I appreciate it. And so I come out of the worst tragedy, hopefully, but certainly to date of my life.
Yeah.
Ironically, with a deeper sense of gratitude, more sadness.
Yeah.
The grief still comes and goes, but a deeper sense of appreciation for what I never appreciated before. Adam calls that post-traumatic growth. We write about it in our book. We believe in pre-traumatic growth. Mm. If you are sitting here or listening and you have not had the trauma, you can still have that appreciation. You can still celebrate a birthday you wouldn't otherwise celebrate or celebrate a friend's birthday and just appreciate that gift because it doesn't happen to everyone.
Don't wait for the bad thing to happen. Live with gratitude. Experience joy now.
Notice them both.
I have to, we're going to shift in 5 minutes, I have to say, because I just got a little note from down below. Q&A starts in 5 minutes. Let me get to a couple last questions on my end here. Any guilt associated with finding joy? I mean, how do you deal with that? Do I have the right to experience happiness? Do I have the right to go on with my life? You know, develop a new relationship, perhaps. You know, at what point is that stuff okay?
Oh, it is so important. I spoke to so many adults who had lost parents as young children, and all of them literally told me they felt bad feeling happy as kids.
Yeah.
So right on the family rules I did with my kids that first week, I wrote, it's okay to feel happy. But I did not extend that kindness to myself. 4 months later, I went to a friend's bar mitzvah. High school friend pulled me onto the dance floor. We danced for a minute to a song I loved. And then I literally just basically kind of collapsed in tears, like literally had to be taken outside. It was super embarrassing. And when he looked at me and said, what's wrong? I realized I felt happy.
For a moment.
For a minute. And then the guilt, I just like, what am I doing on a dance floor feeling good? Dave died 4 months ago. 1 minute, 4 months later. And I was fortunate enough, I was on my way to see Adam with my kids and, you know, his family the next day. And we talked about that, about the guilt of feeling happy. And that was when he said to me, if you don't let yourself feel happy, your kids can't.
Yeah.
And then my brother-in-law gave me the biggest gift in the world. Oh. Right around then, he called me crying on the phone and he said,
this is Dave's brother.
Dave's brother, Rob. He called me and he said, all Dave ever wanted was for you and your children to be happy. He said, don't take that away from him in death.
Oh, beautiful.
And I think that's right.
Yeah.
I think Dave wanted us to be happy. And I think we have to give ourselves that permission because the guilt is so real. There is survivor guilt for cancer survivors, for people who get out of prison while other people remain, for people who, you know, keep a job while other people lose it for someone who survives a spouse.
Yeah.
And that guilt helps no one.
Yeah, you're right.
But we have to fight it.
We do. Well, you know, because I'm on the advisory board, I was fortunate enough to come to the book launch party that you had on the peninsula. And you stood up on that stage and, you know, we all knew that we were present at an event that shouldn't even be happening. We're at an event about a launch of a book that only exists because Dave died. And so we were there in the presence of his loss, of his absence. And there you stood speaking to, you know, these close friends and colleagues and family. And at some point you mentioned the concept of dating again, and Rob, and maybe your mother-in-law. And I turned to the person next to me and I said, did she just say dating? And the person next to me said, yeah, she did. She's continuing to teach us, even in this profound emergence from grief. So
it's permission. You know, we do, we judge people when they date after they lose a spouse, particularly women,
yeah,
much more harshly.
We're supposed to grieve much, much longer.
That's right. Men date sooner. They date more frequently. And I never wanted to date again. I met the person I wanted to spend my life with, but I don't have that choice.
Right.
And I'm lucky because while I definitely faced some, you know, public unkindness, the people closest to me, my mother-in-law and brother-in-law, were the first people to talk to me that you will date again. And when I did, they were hugely supportive. But I think when we think about supporting people through grief, through tragedy, through loss, it is both getting them through the showing up in the hospital, here's the toy, here's dinner, here's the hug, we're in this together, but then rebuilding.
Yeah.
Permission to date, permission to dance, permission to feel joy, building them back up at work. And that is how we build resilience in each other.
Yeah.
By holding them when we cry and then helping them laugh and humor. Mm. Nell Scovell worked on this book as our editor, wrote Lean In With Me. She's a comedy writer. Mm. She stood up at her mother's funeral. She has four siblings and said, with an envelope, I have in here the name of mom's favorite child.
Oh.
At the funeral.
Man.
Mm-hmm. Humor. Yes. Humor, yes. Permission to laugh, even about death. Yeah. I understand now while yes. we make jokes at funerals.
Yeah.
Because it gives us that minute.
Yeah.
That minute to feel better.
Yeah.
And we want to give, Adam and I wrote this book to give people
yeah.
that permission to laugh, even in the face of tragedy, when we need it the most.
I am so happy for you. And I think everyone in this room is so happy for you. We're going to segue to Q&A, but let's just give our guests a big round of applause. All right. A little housekeeping, you all. You've been an amazing audience so far, and I know you're going to continue to be, but you got to listen up now. I think we're going to get some house lights up a little bit. All right. We have staff out in the audience with wireless mics, so please raise your hand, and staff will come to you with a microphone. We would like you to stick to the topic at hand, option B, and related, you know, resilience, joy, grief, loss, option B. Okay? Many of you, as we've already acknowledged and felt, many of you have your own story of loss or tragedy. Please try to ask a question rather than go into the details of your story, not because your story doesn't matter, it does, but simply because we want to try to get through as many questions as we can. And if you're hungry to tell that story, and we know many of you are, please go to optionb.org.
We want your
story. OptionB.org and put the story into the community of Option B. That's what it's there for. All right. With that, we're going to get to as many questions as we can. And where is the first question?
All right. The first question's over here on your left.
This is amazing.
Hello, Adam, Cheryl, and Julie. My name is Rena. And when I was 15, due to family reasons, I had to be the rock of the family. So being resilient has always been a part of me from that point forward. And going forward over the years, especially me being a millennial, we get the label of we're snowflakes, things like that. And I notice over the years, I don't relate to my peers because of my resilience. And so I would like to ask, what is the most appropriate way to communicate in the sense that I'm not condescending, like, oh, you've never been through this, you don't know it. because a lot of, you know, we're getting labeled as snowflakes, and sometimes we just want to, like, share.
I think it's a wonderful question. I think the first and most important thing that you can do is you can share your experience with other people and try to help them understand. Nobody can ever walk in your shoes, but they can learn to take your perspective a little bit more and to empathize a little bit more. I had a pretty distressing experience when I first got to Penn. I had a student who was just amazing. His name was Owen Thomas, and he was his hair was so orange that it looked like his head was on fire when he walked into the classroom. He was the captain of the football team. You wouldn't expect. He sat right in the front row. He took notes diligently. He asked enthusiastic questions. The class loved him. And he came by my office asking for career advice after the semester ended. And then a few weeks later, he died by suicide. And we were all, you know, shocked and devastated. And most of the students on campus had never been through anything like that before. And the first thing that we had to do was we had to make it safe for them to talk about their experience and share their story. And a lot of them were reluctant to do it, saying, well, I wasn't at the center of this tragedy. There are other people who are grieving more. But as they opened up, as they talked to a lot of their friends and, you know, some of their high school classmates even, they gave them a better understanding of what it's like to go through loss, what it's like to go through hardship. And when somebody really close to you is in pain, you feel it too. And I think that's probably the first and most important step.
Thank you.
We have our next question upstairs in the balcony.
Okay. Hi, I'm Emily. I just wanted to say thank you, Cheryl, for sharing your story here with us, and Adam, for sharing your data. That's awesome. I do work at a data analytics company, whoops. But on a serious note, I would just love to really understand, I guess, how you think about giving and helping in general, because we only have so much time, as you've highlighted, obviously, on this planet. So how do we think about giving to others when, you know, you were obviously there, Adam, intensely for Cheryl, but you're also at events like this, giving on a broader scale. With limited time, what do we do? How do you think about that? What's your litmus test, for example?
Well, Adam's first book was Give and Take, and it was the perfect person to answer this question because he's thought so deeply about this.
I hope to one day have an answer to it. I think this is really hard. I think that we face trade-offs every day between how much impact we have on the individuals in our lives and how much we contribute at scale to a broader group or broader community. I think that we need to do both, obviously, whenever we can. I think one of the things I learned from Cheryl's experience, I felt like I was grieving over the loss of Dave, too. But I read this incredible article in the LA Times about how you should draw a circle when there's something bad that happens to people. And you should draw who's at the center of the circle. And then you draw circles around it for each group of people that's affected a little bit more distantly. And then what you should do is you should try to give comfort in and then seek comfort from people who are further removed than you are. And I have found that to be such a helpful guide to say, look, you know, Cheryl and her kids were at the center of this. And so, you know, that's where the need is the greatest. That's where you focus your giving first. And then, you know, if you're struggling or suffering too, you reach out outside the circle for support. I know, you know, I talked to my wife, to my family and my close friends a lot during this experience. And I think that in those moments, there's nothing more meaningful than giving to the people who are close to you. And I think that at the end of the day, matters a lot more than, you know, sort of trying to figure out, okay, how do I give at scale? Because those moments are things that really change our lives and our relationships forever. And I know that I've always looked up to the people in my life who are great friends, who when someone close to them is suffering, there's nowhere else they would want to be. And I think that, you know, we can all do something really meaningful for our friends to try to be that kind of friend.
Nice. Next question.
We have a question down here on your right.
Hi, I'm Sarah. Thank you so much for broaching this important topic. I think it's something we definitely don't speak about enough. And Cheryl, you were mentioning how in a leadership role, how you can see how you can impact other employees that are going through grief or experiencing bereavement. When I lost my father about a year and a half ago, something that I struggled with the most was trying to communicate with my manager, manage the workload, et cetera. I would love to hear your thoughts on tips for employees working with their managers to try to educate them about what we need and how you think we can speak in a way that'll be most receptive to leadership in our organizations.
And that's part of why we wrote this book, because if we can't talk about these things in the personal sphere, as Julie said, the workplace is even more a place we don't talk. I wrote in Lean In about bringing your whole self to work, about being who we are and recognizing that we don't just turn off our personal needs, wants, or both joys and tragedies when we come into the office. And so I think the best way we form the best working relationships is by being open to that. It's easier for me to do that because I am one of the senior people, and so I can help set the tone, which is definitely part of what we're trying to do with Option B, not just for my company, but having those conversations with other leaders of other companies. But I think anyone can do this by sitting down and saying, look, I know this isn't discussed much at work, but I need to tell you where I'm coming from and what's going on with me, and I need to ask for your help. And asking for help, to the point we made earlier, both in the context of school and the amazing program that Stephen and Danny started, but even in the workplace, there is a lot of evidence that when we ask for help, it doesn't just build relationships one way, it builds relationships both ways. And I'm not saying every manager is going to react well, even though I sure hope they will, but I think we can start with those conversations and have those high expectations and show by example what companies can be. We spend, if you work full-time and you take out the sleeping hours, most people spend more time at work than at home. And so if we want to build resilience, to have supportive communities, to have supportive colleagues and relationships, we are going to have to find a way to do this in the workplace, not just in our schools and our communities, where we also need to do it. We have to be able to do it at work. And that means recognizing that, you unpack it all, we are so human. And in what we do every day and how we relate to each other, that humanity, the times we need help, the times we are grieving, those times are so important to be there for each other.
And I'm going to say, Sarah, sometimes you got to quit your job. I don't know. I think that's the ultimate lean in, is to say, I'm out of here, okay? Because what people joke, I think it's true. There's probably some data on this, right? No, people don't leave jobs. They leave bosses. If your boss does not recognize that you are a human being, then you may need, and I acknowledge this is something you can do if you have a certain degree of means, such that you have a little flexibility, such that you can leave that job and find another. Okay, I'm not saying everybody can automatically do this. But if you can, search your soul to figure out, can I? Because if that work environment is crushing the life out of you, you need to reclaim the self. You have to stand up for yourself when they won't and get out of there. And I speak from having been a young litigation associate at a law firm, lost my dad, and I was told you'd really need to get your hours up. And 3 months after, and I thought, you know, that was the first day I began looking for another job. And I have never regretted it. All right. The next question.
Right, we have a question over here on your left.
Okay.
Hi, Adam. Hi, Cheryl. My name is Patrick. I'm lucky that I haven't experienced the grief and the loss that's been talked about on stage today. So what I want to ask is, aside from reading Option B, and aside from practicing more generosity and more gratitude, what's something I should do after this talk to better prepare myself for loss and grief that will inevitably come in the future?
Nice.
Relationships.
Yeah, I mean, I think one of the realities of Cheryl's experience is she had incredible friends and family step up for her. And she won't talk about this, but one of the reasons she had so many people there for her is because she was that friend to so many of those people. She's been on the giving end of every friendship that I know of in her life. And investing in those relationships is the single most important thing that you can do to prepare for whatever may come in your life, because that's how you build a community that has your back. And, you know, I think that's the thing that I would say do immediately, is take care of the people around you, help them, support them, not because you want something back, but because you want to be in the kind of relationship where that's how people take care of each other and that's how they treat each other.
And we've talked about the forms of, yeah, it's amazing. The forms of post-traumatic growth, we find more meaning, we find more gratitude, we can really understand and experience joy. We can do that, again, before tragedy. So my friend Katie Minnick, wonderful friend, After Dave died, she was very close to Dave, she started writing long letters to her close friends on their birthdays, telling them why she loved them and how much she valued the relationship, but like long, specific, a form of joy and gratitude on her friends' birthdays. And then a friend of hers who doesn't know us and doesn't know Dave and hadn't experienced any loss, she started writing those letters to her friends on her birthdays because she got one from Katie. That is that kind of pre-traumatic growth, right? That friend was investing in her relationships, making people feel a moment of joy, making people feel how much she appreciated them and deepening those relationships and doing it without any trauma. And we do want option B to help prepare people for trauma, but we hope the trauma never comes. But the gratitude, you know, if I could give what I would give to go back and live one day with Dave, knowing what I know now, you know, knowing how precious that those days were, that we'd only have 11 years of them, feeling the joy that I don't always feel, but when I do, the real gratitude for the experience of life, what would I do to have a day like that? And I can't do that. But I can have that with my friends on this stage today. I can have that with my children when I see them in the morning for breakfast, and other people can have that as well. And that is not just the preparation for trauma, but just living a deeper life.
And I'll add, it's about showing up. You know, we're talking about almost the most unthinkable kind of grief here, but loss includes loss of a job. It includes divorce. Mm-hmm. It includes so many different things. And when we can just show up in the lives of our friends and loved ones who've had something terrible happen like that, you show up at your friend's apartment door, you know, when they've lost their job or their spouse has run out on them, you know, they'll never forget that you were the one who came and just sat with them when they didn't even know what to do. So just showing up in each other's lives is, I think, you know, one of the greatest gifts we can give another human, and it's easy. You know, we just need to have the will and the desire to do it. Okay, we have time for two more questions. I know. Let's get it.
We have one upstairs.
One upstairs in the mystery lights, yes.
Cheryl, I remember when this happened, and I think most people here remember when this happened, and that's because you're a public person and you're a leader. And I think option B answers the question already, that you are here, you created a community to help others, but how did you get to that point? And can you talk about sort of reckoning the reality of your tragedy with the other reality that people are listening to you and they're watching you?
I was sorry that at first when Dave died, I was pretty sorry I had written Lean In, because I realized if I hadn't written Lean In and written about my marriage, you know, I wouldn't be living this as publicly, even as a CEO of a company, and I would have unwritten that book many times. Then I thought about what I got, you know, dead wrong in that book, which is, you know, I wrote about different forms of family, but I also wrote a whole chapter called Make Your Partner a Partner.
Yeah.
And I didn't really think through, I think, how hard that would be to read if you didn't have one.
Yeah.
You know, when I became a single parent, I thought harder about what it is to be a single mother in this country. 37% living in poverty, 40% if you're Black or Latina, going through all the grief I went through and being worried about paying a bill, getting evicted. I mean, these things are real. But for me, it was really that Facebook post that led to this book. We didn't decide to write it till much later, but when I did that post, it took the elephants out of the room. And not the grief, but the isolation really changed. People started saying, how are you today? And what can I, you know, showing up more. And I felt more connected. And for me, you know, a lot of the personal parts of the book come from the journals I kept, obviously edited. But they come from my journals, so it wasn't that I had to write the really hard stuff for the book. What we wrote for the book was the research and were other people's stories. And the research for me really helped, because there's decades of people studying, really smart people looking at what helps people recover from really hard circumstances and knowing, okay, this is something that I can do for my kids that was proven was so comforting for me. And the stories, you know, we've talked again about Stephen and Danny who are here and other people here and other wells who have faced so much adversity and overcome and learn and still struggle, but share their experiences, those gave me hope. And so for me, the process of writing, it was honoring Dave, it was healing for me, and the community response has been just amazing. So we launched optionb.org. Rachel Thomas, who's the president of my foundation and launched this with a lot of our team, are here tonight, and they've done the most extraordinary job. And, you know, we have almost 300,000 people in the Option B big group. And then we have these small groups that Julie helped us launch, and one is on coping with loss. And Monday, as Julie said, was the anniversary of Dave's death, and I did a post into that group. And it was raw and honest, and it was grief. And it's not a post I would have done publicly, and it's not even a post I would have shared with my closest friends. About a year ago, someone who I'm still very close to looked at me one day and said, "You're done with that grief thing, right?" No, he didn't mean it. He hadn't experienced it.
Pretty sure he's just a bad person.
No. No. No, he's not.
He doesn't speak the language.
He's not. But Option B, the Option B coping with loss group.
They get it.
It's now, it was when I posted on Monday, it was 3,200 people. I checked right before. It's 3,900 people. I don't know them. But I did the honest post Monday about what Monday felt like, which was horrible. Monday was horrible. And it was a place I could do that, and they're all doing that. And being part of that community, it's helping me so much. And there's this one little story, but it meant a lot to me. There was a woman who posted that she hadn't read the book yet because she couldn't afford it, but she had read a lot of the articles. And so I privately messaged her and said, "Get me your address, I'll send you a book." And she wrote back that someone else anonymously from the community already sent her a book.
Beautiful. Beautiful.
And how grateful she was.
Yep.
And this helping other people, for me, that's the path that led here. And I think it honors, for those of you who knew Dave, and there are so many people here who did, Dave Goldberg's life. Well,
last question.
We have a question down here on your right.
Okay.
Thank you, Cheryl, for being such an inspiration for all of us. So you just mentioned that in Lean In, you wrote about making your partner a real partner, and then you acknowledged that many women just don't have the choice or just don't have the option. What would be your advice to all those women who do not have that option of having a real partner?
I think we need better workforce policies. We need better public support systems. The poverty levels that single parents and most 84% of single parents or single mothers are living with are unacceptable. In a society, you know, a country as wealthy as ours, we need to fix our companies. There's no mother or father who should wake up today and tomorrow, and it will happen all over this country, and choose between keeping a job and taking care of a sick child. So we need to fix that. I think we also need to recognize the growing reality, which is the family structure in the United States. Fewer and fewer people are living in what was the image of a man, woman, and the white picket fence. Family means all kinds of different things to all kinds of people. And I think we need to be there for each other with supportive friendships, supportive communities, schools, workplaces. Even when you were parenting alone, you are less alone. And that is the kind of community that we can all seek to build when we build resilience in each other, because everyone deserves that support and everyone needs it.
All right, y'all. That was the last audience question. But we're not done. Yes. Okay, you're applauding. Okay, fine. I'm doing my best here. All right. It's an in-forum tradition to close every event like this, and I don't think there's ever been an event quite like this, may I say. These two have been incredible. But it's an informed tradition to ask speakers the following question. So this is the last question. What is your 60-second idea to make the world a better place? Cheryl passes the box to Adam. Yeah. Adam!
Get Sheryl Sandberg to say shit on stage more often. I think... In 60 seconds, I think the biggest thing that I've learned through this whole process is we all know people in our lives who are in pain, and we often don't know that they're in pain. And reaching out, offering to help, stepping up, I think that makes a huge difference. It helps all of us find strength, and it helps all of us remember why life is worth living.
Nice.
Be there for each other. Build resilience in each other. Find the laughter, find the joy, hold each other as we cry. But don't let anyone go through it alone, because I don't think people can.
Cheryl, Adam, thank you for the gift of your leadership and your wisdom. Thank you for your kindness in writing this book for the rest of us. Let's give a huge Castro Theater round of applause to Cheryl and Adam for being with us tonight here at Inforum at the Commonwealth Club. And a big thank you to all of you for joining us as well.